doing another one of the Nature's Table Oral History Project, and today is Tuesday, March 14th at Smith Music Hall, and I'm Jeff Machota, and I'm here with Joan Hickey.
Hi, Jeff.
And basically, we're here to talk about Nature's Table and what brought you to Champaign-Urbana and to Nature's Table. So you can start wherever you want to start.
Okay, I'll just start with the fact that I was an undergrad in music education, and I didn't start playing jazz till my senior year, my last semester of senior year of college. So the first group that I sort of stayed two more years after that. So the first group I was in was with Brad Wheeler, Jeff Stitely, Marlene Rosenberg, and Steve Thomas, who's a trumpet player, called the Out of Nowhere Quintet. And as far as Nature's Table, I don't recall exactly, you know, when I started playing there or with who, but it was definitely a combination of Rhonda War and Mike Friedman and, you know, Karen Korsmeyer on bass and Mike Friedman drummer. And it was just essential to my education. It was just absolutely, you know, I was playing with Rhonda War and I probably knew 10 tunes. And so it was a little backwards because, you know, instead of learning some of the most common standards that you would learn first, you know, like Body and Soul, I was learning tunes he wanted to do, which were, you know, like Wayne Shorter tunes and stuff like that, because that's what he wanted to play. So I don't know exactly chronologically how things went down, but my main recollections were listening to or playing with Lynn Halliday and DeWar, and then on from that, because that was like the core.
So you weren't studying jazz at the university, or you were at the very...
There's no jazz program until 10 years ago.
Yeah, but you weren't working the big band or anything with Garvey?
Well, a little bit on the... Well, back then, you didn't have to be a student, so Bill French was the piano player for every semester, you know? And so there were these ringers that were in there, so if you wanted to move up the ranks, you couldn't because they were in there. And so... But I played in Ray Sasaki's in the second band, and I played with lower bands. I played in a band that Bill Overton directed. I played a band that Tom Berkner directed. And again, you didn't have to be a student, so I wasn't a student at that point. I was hanging out.
So you graduated and you were just hanging out in town. And so what was the scene like when you found, were you playing other places besides Nature's Table or before it started, or...
Well, there was a lot of, because I think there's good and bad about the jazz program. There's obviously good because it brings a lot of people in, and it's a for real program.
The program now.
But the problem is no one has time to practice or jam, so everyone's scrambling just to finish what they, you know, their study. So I was free. I was just, you know, playing in a, I was like, you know, waitressing or playing in a, you know, a Elvis impersonator band, and I had the rest of my time free, so I just practice, get together a lot of just jam sessions in various spaces.
Who was the Elvis impersonator?
Tommy Seaman.
I've heard stories.
Doug Pugh, what's his name? Doug Pugh, he's still around. He's a bass player that was in the band with me. That's a whole another interview, but I don't really recall other gigs. There were now and then, but Nature's Table was like the fun place to play.
So how did you hear about it? Like, do you remember what you're like? You walked by one day and saw it, or you just heard people talking about it? So my recollection,
I can't remember.
So as far as I know, so spring of or fall of '79, Terry opened Nature's Table as a Whole Foods place. Then he and Shelley got together by like January of 80, they started doing music.
Okay.
And I know the first record we have of you is playing there in the summer of 1980. So you were there when...
Yeah, it was pretty much from, you know, it's near the beginning. So
all the people you mentioned, like Stitely, and were those all your contemporaries at the time? Like, mm-hmm. Did they, so yeah. You were all learning together.
I'm having some trouble with the connection. Please try. try again in a moment.
Is that your phone? You're getting recording it double. Yeah, I would say that. And but my first, you know, I said I started so late, and I would go to Trino's and hear the big bands play. And Art Davis and Joel and some of those guys that were still in Champaign at the time, Bill Overton and DeWar, of course. And so my education was, you know, in addition to Nature's Table and Trino's and that, was just hanging out at parties and listening to Larry Gianeski. Remember him? Did you know him? Hanging out at parties and
what did he play?
Saxophone. Alto, mostly. Just hearing them talk about, you know, it would, the whole party would be listening to records. That would, what the party would be centered around, and they would point out things in the music that I wasn't hearing, and then I would listen to, you know, so I was, they'd say, oh, did you hear that? And I'd think, no, I didn't hear that. And then they'd play it five more times, you know, just messing around. And so that was my, I feel like that was my jazz education degree, where it was at parties. And so, yeah, there was the big bands were, unlike now, I feel like the big Garvey band was like, that was like the core of the jazz musical and social scene. And then if people did small group things outside of that, that was great. But I felt like that was like where everybody always came to those gigs, and it was a great band. And Brian Sanders was still here, and a bunch of people. So anyway.
And those gigs were places like Trino's?
Yeah, mostly Trino's and that. Yeah, sometimes Krannert. But so that was sort of my education. But for playing, Lynn Halliday showed up kind of out of nowhere. And at the time, Ron DeWar really wasn't, he was in one of those phases of not playing that much jazz. He was only playing this hot band.
The Jack Webb band?
The Nighthawks.
Okay, then I think it morphed into the Jack Webb band, because that was the first band Terry booked at the table.
Was that after the Nighthawks?
After the Nighthawks,
yeah. Okay, well, anyway, one of those two. But he was playing soprano in those, and he really, or clarinet, and he wasn't playing any tenor. And Lynn Halliday is a tenor player that I don't know where it came from. I think he was in, like, in a mental institution or something. He has this, like, whole span of time that no one knows. It was just kind of, like, lost. and he's a tenor player that was in New York. He was, do you know much about Lynn?
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah, he was in New York. He from Arkansas. He had this little southern accent, kind of like, you know, kind of a hick, basically. And but what's important about Lynn is that he inspired Ron to start playing the tenor again, and they played a bunch of gigs, two tenor gigs, and so that was a really exciting time. I remember hearing them with Campbell and Joel and maybe Kelly, or I can't remember, one, various bass players, maybe Marlene, and it was just smoking. I mean, I think I gave you some of those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And everybody had microphones strewn, hung up, just like 20, 30 microphones. Everybody was recording it. And so I do remember everybody was really, really into it and listening. And we had been talking before the interview. I was trying to recall if people talked as much as they do, like at the Iron Post and that. I remember it being fairly quiet, and that was my favorite thing about playing at Nature's Table, was that, A, the drums were like right next to me. I love having everything real close, and B, everybody was listening to the, not just quiet, but they were listening. You could feel them listening. You could feel, like when you played something, you could, you know, there was, it was very, very, I just had the sensitivity that was like really focused, and that was what was so, everybody loved about playing there, because I was very few times ever since then I felt that, where people were listening that intently and, you know, experiencing it along with you. And
were there big crowds when you guys were playing?
I remember it being big. It's certainly when I played with Lynn and Ron or something. But, I remember it being quite
And that's
big.
When Nature's Table, before it, the music was in the southernmost part of it.
I remember two spots. The piano was on the south end, and then the piano on the east end by the windows.
Okay.
Right?
Then the music shifted to the other side later by the mid-80s. Terry knocked down a wall that was kind of dividing it.
But in addition to the audience listening so intently, that's how it was like to play with DeWar was, he'd be soloing and I'd do the slightest thing on the piano and he would react to it. Whether it was like I messed, I flinched or made up, it was, that kind of intense listening that really taught me how to play and completely taught me how to comp, because you can't learn how to comp unless you have somebody to comp for, And, with that, in my teaching and like in high school students, the piano player is always more mature because of the nature of the instrument. You have the whole orchestra right there, so they tend to understand harmony and stuff faster than the horn players, and the horn players are still getting their sound together and that kind of thing. And it just seems to be an issue because, like, they can't learn to comp because they're more advanced than anybody they're comping for. And I was, way a beginner. And so I learned, I could feel myself improving, like, in one night. Like, literally, within 2 hours, I could feel, it was a super incredible, experience in that way to be thrown in there playing that level of, musicianship going on. And they were very, patient with me for the most part.
What did you think of the piano?
I liked the piano. It was great. It kind of, got beat up after a while, but when he got it, it was like freshly rebuilt. It wasn't a new piano, I don't think. I can't remember, but it was all spiffy at first. It was very nice.
So what do you recall early memories of Terry when you first met Terry or when you first went to the place before you played? Or?
Yeah, they're both just super mellow and fun and, easygoing. And, Shelley would dance and Terry would work. And the only time I got in trouble once because I was... Sarity was in a playpen in the back, and I just had this urge to get in there with her, and I asked Shelley, can I get in the playpen with her? She said, sure. And of course, my weight, I wasn't, 8 pounds, so I broke the playpen, and Terry got pissed, and, I believe I tried to pay him back from, a couple times when we got gigs. Instead of paying, I just gave him my money. And so he never really said, it cost this much. I had no idea how much a playpen cost. So I don't know if I paid him back properly or not, but I felt so terrible. But he looked at her like, what are you doing? Looked at me and her. I just remember... I don't really remember any specific stories.
Did you ever go there to eat? Or was it more just to play?
Yeah, I'm sure I did. During the day for lunch, yeah. It's a little vague, but a little hazy. But yeah, I did.
So the first band you put together, you said, had Brad Wheeler, Jeff Stitely.
Yeah, I can't remember if we played there or not, but... I was pretty resourceful, and I would go out and talk places and hire me. I don't remember exactly the first gigs I had at the table, but Stitely on drums or Mike Friedman. Did you ever, who that is?
Yeah. Okay. Was he still here at that point, or Mike Friedman, or had he left?
Yeah, he was still
here. Okay.
And that was my boyfriend. I know, you come from a long list of drummers, long line of drummers. And I don't know, what else?
What kind of stuff were you guys playing with that band?
Well, again, everything really. Ron DeWar kind of like launched everything, like the tunes he liked to play, the way he, you know, his embouchure, all the saxophone players played with his kind of mouthpiece, and, you know, everybody did their setup, like, you know, the pictures of Ron in their bedrooms. I mean, he was like the focus of you know, how to play. And so what tunes he liked to play, then that's probably what I was always really into the Jazz Messengers, and so do stuff like that. When I moved to Chicago, that was the first group I started there, was a Art Blakey Jazz Messengers band, sextet.
What year did you move to Chicago?
I don't remember exactly. I don't like to talk. I don't remember dates. But I would come back and play. And that's why you see some of these later dates, like in 85 or 86 and stuff like that. And sometimes with Ron, but sometimes with, I brought Rusty Jones. I brought Robert Shy one time.
Those are both drummers.
Yes. And so I don't remember, you know, exactly.
Here's
when
one
everybody
from 81 with Steve Thomas, Brad Wheeler, Joan Hickey, Steve Thomas.
Oh yeah, that was the Out of Nowhere Quintet.
Okay. That was from 81.
And
these aren't comprehensive for sure. So 85, yeah, with Rusty Jones. And then,
but that's a great the photo of Lynn and
87 is with Art Davis and Phil Gratteau.
Phil Gratteau, uh-huh. Yeah, so those are always fun. And I always remember a good crowd. I mean, it's such a small place. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's always a night when it's, you know, quiet, but the smaller it is, the more filled up it looks. And there was a lot of dancing going on, because it wasn't just Shelley, but it was Chuck. There was a guy named Chuck.
Chuck Seagard.
Oh, yeah? You know who Chuck?
Yeah.
Okay. Chuck did a lot of dancing.
He's still around. Really?
Mm-hmm. And so there was a whole group of, you know, people dancing in between all the people. It was just like this whole cool vibe. It was very, you know, everything was very, very positive.
So once you moved to Chicago, why come back to play at Nature's Table when there's all these clubs in Chicago?
Well, for the reason I said earlier, there was something, just no place was like that fun to play because of the vibe and the level of listening, you know, the astute listening that it's very gratifying.
It was worth it financially to drive down, or just everything was cheaper then, so it didn't matter?
No, it was just for that. It was just for the fulfillment of artistic fulfillment. You know, we weren't background music. You know, you could make more money playing somewhere for background, but you know, it's a balance.
I know you gave me some recordings of some of the early stuff with Len Halliday. I got to see him once at the Get Me High Lounge.
Oh yeah.
In the late 80s, I don't remember who was
with
playing
him there.
Maybe you were on the gig I saw.
Maybe. He played there a lot.
But that's one time. But then he did record 3 or 4 CDs for Delmark near the end of his life.
Oh, yeah.
With the multi-instrumentalist Ira Sullivan.
Oh, okay.
Trumpet. And.
Oh, right. He was friends with Ira.
Yeah. And he died, like in 91 or 92, I think. Because I started doing my show at WEFT, and I ended up doing a little tribute. Joe Groans came. And we did a little tribute to him.
Lynn was a drop dead, you know, he sounded just like early Sonny Rollins. Like Sonny Rollins from this like thin slice of his career, like a specific, you know, and I don't know the exact years, but, you know, like, that was what he zeroed in on. He sounded just like him, and it was awesome. And he played just those tunes. He just kept playing those tunes over and over again. That's the only tunes he, you know, they wasn't a huge repertoire, but he played the hell out of those tunes. And he used to come over when we both got to Chicago. He would come over to my, I was at my parents for a year or so before I got an apartment or whatever, and I would have jam sessions there, and he'd come over there, and just say, you know, Joni, let's just do Arigen again. You know, it's like the same, you know, same tunes, like they're brand new. And he moved to Chicago, and he lived at the Lawson YMCA, which is like pretty sketchy. And something happened where somebody shot him in the head, and he had these bullets, but they couldn't do surgery because it was too close. So we just left him in there. And so on gigs, he'd say, oh, Joni, I'll be right back. I got to go down the street for some Anacin and some squares. And that was his phrase. You know, he's like, a bump in a square, which is a drink and a cigarette. But anyway, it was really cool that he, in the way he inspired Ron and I don't know if you listened to any of those, the two of them.
Yeah,
I'm waiting for my golden years to do that, you know. It's when I have time to just sit and, you know, listen to them. And those are accessible. Remind me where those are located.
We have them all located on archive.org, but the physical ones are at the Sousa Archive. But there's at least one that's posted at naturestable.net right now.
Okay, archive.
I can send you the links to where they are.
It's been a while, so I don't remember. I'm sure you told me once before.
So when you would bring musicians down, were most of the musicians people who had been here at one time, or were you just said, hey, there's this place in Urbana I want you to check out with people who listen and come out?
A little both. And they always enjoyed it. They're always, you know, for a little road trip. And I think they all really, because it was, you know, Terry would take the door and everybody would be very, you know, appreciative of us coming, you know, down, taking the trip and everything, and everybody always enjoyed it. I can't remember where we stayed, or did we just drove back or what. I can't remember how I dealt with that. That's still a problem, you know, when I want people to come down, I got to figure out housing for them and that. But that's the...
Do you remember, besides gigs that you were on, do you remember a scene? Anybody, like, were you there, like, when Dave Liebman played, or...?
Yes. Yes, I was there for that. That was really great. Not only the music, but being able to hang out with him and his stories that he told. He told some great stories about Miles and about Elvin, and yeah, that was great. Yeah, I mean, Campbell played there quite a bit, and I consider him sort of my mentor, because he was, you know, when I was learning to play, that was the guy I'd, you know, listened to a lot and learned a lot from. And
But he never lived here, right? Didn't he just commute here from Bloomington, or did he actually live in town?
No, I don't think so. But then in Chicago,
too.
I'm just saying that was like in my formative years. That was like my guy that I listened to. You know, I always go to their gigs and everything. Yeah, I remember that. I can't remember. I mostly remember the gigs I'm mentioning with Campbell Trio or Lynn and Ron, and who else came? I don't know.
A lot of this stuff were before I was there. Some of the people who came in. I know Liebman was one that people talked about a lot. So when you're teaching now, how do you convince students to have similar experiences to what you had back then, or is it hard to? Like hanging out or playing or...
Well, I do talk about trying to listen to jazz together, you know, listen to recording and stuff instead of just everything in their head, in their earbuds, because there's so much they can share with each other, and I mean, they do that, the college students that are into it, that are into jazz. I mean, there's jazz majors that really don't even care about jazz. They just couldn't find a place to be a rock major, you know. But there's other ones that are really into it, and they're at this point, they're already doing that. But I have a lot of really talented high school students as well in Chicago, and I always talk about, like, you know, find a record you really like, and find somebody to like it with, you know, because then you're, the excitement level is a different, you know, it's just more fun to listen to with somebody else because they hear different something, you share something that you hadn't heard before, and you, that's just kind of, and you play along, things, some of the old school things, like just put a record on and play with it, just play, just comp, you know, even though there's already a piano player, just play with it. Because I know that that's what the, you know, that's what the old school guys used to do. And the aesthetic of the Garvey guy, you know, that I think that rubbed off on everyone was that it was important to swing, to be able to have a great swing, the great rhythmic feel, and to strive to be yourself. And which, what at the time, you know, was very different than like the North Texas thing, which was, you know, more competitive, more higher, faster, louder. And the vibe of, you know, these parties, of these listening to records, and what was happening at Nature's Table was all about, you know, how great can you make it feel? And, you know, what can you do to make it your own? And that, you know, was carried with me for me and for my, when I passed on my students. And so I pride myself on trying to instill a high aesthetic in my students. Like, you know, what's good and what's, okay, that's, you know, that's really, everybody thinks it's good, but it's, you know, really listen to that, you know what I mean? And to have an artistic, you know, barometer that's your own, that isn't swayed by, well, X amount of people like it, so it must be good, kind of thing. And so it's a little bit, you know, it's a little bit snobby, I guess, in that way. And maybe I got that from the people there too. Even though everybody felt, I feel like everybody was open, you know, open-minded about music and stuff. But anyway, that's all these core things came out of, you know, Nature's Table, and, you know, the Garvey Band, and that was like shaped everything.
Did you ever play with Doc Scott?
Yeah, I think I did. I think maybe at Zorba's, definitely, or maybe at Nature's Table.
Because Doc was doing a lot of his own tunes. I recall at least by the mid-80s, he was playing a lot of his own music.
I don't remember playing too many of like his gigs where he would play his tunes. It was more like a jam session situation where we're just playing tunes. Yeah. Who else?
Well, I know you had some encounters with Guido Sinclair, right?
Yeah, I had. Oh well, Ray. That was Ray and Morgan when I was in, maybe it was when I was in Ray's band. I don't know. And I played a few jam sessions at Morgan's when they lived in this 2-flat in Urbana. Ray lived upstairs and Morgan lived downstairs, and Morgan had a grand piano, and so I got to play some little jams with them. And then Ray would have a couple of parties. Well, Bill Overton would, you know, really spice up these parties, to say the least. And he would do all kinds of crazy stuff. And I may have been visiting that time that maybe I told you that story where I was staying at, I was, you know, staying on the couch or whatever at Ray's house, and there had been a party and it went very late, and I remember trying to sleep and woke up and Guido was, I always had Guido, Guido was making breakfast. I think Lynn had been there too. I don't know. Guido was, he was uninvited, but he was taking the food out of the fridge and making, helping himself to making omelets or something way too early. Because those old junkie guys never sleep. They just don't sleep. They're just up all night. I remember that with Lynn. Everybody be sacked out at, you know, 3 in the morning, and he'd have his little transistor, he'd little cassette player, and he'd be listening to, you know, Sonny Rollins. And I don't know what it is about that, but that was just like a byproduct of, side effect of that. And so I knew that he was not supposed to be there and hadn't been invited, and I was trying to sleep, and I was crabby and hungover and got in this big fight with him and told him to get out or I'm going to call the police. It wasn't even my house. But I decided that I had more right to be there than him, I guess. I don't know. And he said, "What are you coming on like Betty Grable?" So, like, oh, that's cool. I kind of like that.
So, were you contemporary when Lawrence Hobgood was playing as well? Was Lawrence playing there at the time that you were playing?
Yeah.
Table.
Yeah, in fact, I remember, I think I had moved to Chicago and he was still here and he said, "I don't know, I can't decide, should I move to Chicago?" And I'm like, "Yeah, sure, you should go." I encouraged him to make the big move. Yeah. I know there's other people.
Mike Coker?
Yeah, absolutely. I remember hearing him play at Nature's Table. And I guess Dan Anderson?
Mm-hmm. Dan was down here. I think Dan was here, then he came back at a certain point, too. I think he left and came back. And
yeah, I'm sure they're leaving out some people, but... But, you know, somebody like, "Hey, this guy's in town, let's play," you know. It was very, as I said, unlike now, people had more time to just do that. Just
so the years you were here and then when you left, you were pretty much just playing all the time.
Yes.
Playing or listening.
You mean when I moved to Chicago?
Yeah, I mean from when you were here in Champaign and then when you moved up there, that period you were just doing lots of playing and listening.
When I was here or when I was in Chicago?
Both.
Well, as soon as I got to Chicago, I got a steady gig. I got, okay, like a great gig, yeah.
Where were you?
Like within 2 months. Not the Four Seasons. That was my second. The Mayfair Region Hotel, which was on Oak Street. It's not there anymore, but there's one like that in New York called the Pierre, I think. And John Campbell had gotten a steady gig there, piano, you know, solo. And they wanted someone, you know, 5 nights a week or 7 nights a week, and so he got me on another shift. So I was making great money, like, immediately. It was...
Just playing solo?
Yeah, playing solo piano, and then, as I said, I started that sextet gig. I used to take the door at Orphans for the Jazz Members Big Band, who are now called the Chicago Jazz Orchestra, and got to know the owners or the manager, whoever... Actually, yeah, Orphans. And so he gave me my first gig with a sextet. There was just, you know, like a lot of places, tons of places to play. And I did a lot of leading. I led that, you know, a lot of groups around. And then the Campbell Trio played a lot of at a place called the Piano Man, which is also on Lincoln Avenue. And played there. And so. But, you know, it's. There's still a lot of work to get those gigs and make a lot. You have to call 20 times to get one gig, and you know, and sometimes it would be once a week type, you'd get the steady gig, but you had asked about Nature's Table, and it was just easy. You know, you could just call up and they say, "Yeah, here's a date, come down." It wasn't any, you didn't have to go through any hoops or talking anybody into anything, or you know what I mean? Very accepting.
Were a lot of the people who were in the audience, were they actually musicians as well? Were there a lot of the people from the school hanging out, or was it more people from the community, or a mixture?
I think it was just a mixture, because, as I said, there was no jazz program, so it wasn't really that many jazz musicians. That's why I was able to play with Rhonda War. I mean, there just weren't that many piano players. Otherwise, I would never have been able to play with these great musicians. So it was just like a bunch of hippies.
Because I remember by like the mid to later 80s, a lot of the people that were in the big bands, like, there would always be a sector that would come and hang and play, but then there was a lot of people who would never come, it would seem like.
Right, from the, they played in the bands, yeah.
Yeah. And I know there was, you know, so they could have been education people, or they weren't, you know, yeah. It wasn't all.
Exactly, but that's what I was saying about the jazz program now. I mean, there's some people that are, like, totally committed to it, and some people that's, like, just, like, their little hobby that they do once a week. And, you know,
I can't imagine
they're not
in
gonna,
this day and age with the cost that people could not be committed to it.
Well, they're committed to another kind of music.
Oh, okay.
Like, they're into hip-hop. You can't major in hip-hop, so, I mean, they, you know, they become it's like a default major. You could, I suppose, maybe at Berkeley or something, and maybe they have more commercial music degrees in other schools, but it's sort of a catch-all. You know, if it's not classical, then you just dump them in the jazz program, kind of a thing. It could be, you know, people are into all kinds of different music now. And a lot of the jazz majors play in jazz groups, and they also play in funk groups, and they also play in, you know, all different kinds. And they're into, like, you know, producing their own whatever. So that's all cool. But yeah, you're right. Yeah, I don't remember. I don't remember a lot about the crowd, but, you know, it was like now. There'd be like those guys, you know, regulars that you'd always see, and then they'd be. But it was such a great location, you know, because it was so close to everything.
As I was walking,
walk over.
I don't come to campus much, but as I was walking past today, it's just like that huge, huge building that takes up the whole block now.
So what happened? The university.
So Terry never owned that space.
He rented it,
and it was cheap rent because they didn't really. Terry did all the work on the property, but there was the three spaces.
You mean he built the inside and the you mean talked about
a lot of the stuff? Yeah, I mean, I think it had been a restaurant before, but he did a lot of the reworking of it. But there was Horizon Books was on one end. There was it was kind of three little spaces. Then there was a space in the middle, which the entire time I was there was always empty. So the Horizon Books guy owned his part. The middle part, university owned, and Terry owned the end. So it was always known that they wanted that space. And they started making more noises in like 89 or 90. And then in 91, they basically said, well, 90, I think they said, we're going to take it. So May 91 was the end.
Right, because he didn't own it, so he had no say.
Yeah. So we just had a big, like, two-day party.
Yeah.
And then they took the keys away. Terry took everything out, and then they tore it down within a couple months. But then it just sat there empty for a few years before they built the building. But I mean, I know he tried to look at places and other people tried to look at stuff, but the location of it being right on campus where the lunchtime business supported a lot of the work that went on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because there was so many people there. And then nighttime within, you know, blocks of
right,
there's here, blocks of Cranard, you know, across the street from Cranard.
No, it was great. There's still not enough places to go to lunch around here that would be that you had that nice healthy food and everything. Yeah, it was great to have that location. And I know he told me about some place they tried to get in downtown Champaign and were up to the, you know, they were like bidding against somebody else. Do you remember that? Wasn't
I don't know.
And I mean, this was not long, this was just like a year before he died or something. And they didn't get it. So they granted it to somebody else, but he was close. He was going to start another place. Did they have music at the place on Philo?
When he first opened it, so they took the kids out of school and they went to Mexico right after it closed for a year, but it wasn't a year. So it was about, I don't know, 6 or 7 months. And then he had bought that place on Philo and Washington.
Yeah.
And
what was the name of it?
It became Sweet Betsy's.
Yeah.
It was a gas station, I think, or had been at one
and
point.
And when did they?
So then he turned it into the restaurant, but it was too tiny. He had music a little bit the first year or so, but it was, I mean,
smaller.
I think there was, you could fit more people in your office than in there. I mean, it wasn't very big. Especially when you put, he had the piano in there. The Mason Hamlin was in there.
Yeah, I remember, I don't know if I ever went there, but.
But it was just, it was also
really far
off the beaten path. I mean, that's becoming more popular now.
Yeah.
It's a Mexican restaurant, and it's actually does the most business that space has ever done, so.
Oh, all right, that was it. Right next to Jean's.
Yes. Well, she came later.
Yeah. But that space.
Yeah, that space.
Okay. Oh, they went to Mexico, and then they came back, and then they opened that. That reminds me of, speaking of, like, having a goodbye party. DeWar decided he was going to move to Eureka, California. I don't know if this is, I think I had already left. I can't remember. I'd already gone to Chicago, moved to Chicago. But maybe he had met Sue. I can't remember. Maybe, I don't remember exactly the order. But there was something in Eureka, or somebody, maybe that's where she wanted to go. But he moved to Eureka, California. He wanted to move there, and it was a big deal. It was like, Ron's leaving, and everyone's... So we had this big, you know, gig and goodbye party, like T-shirts made and, you know, all this stuff. And he didn't like... It was like 2 weeks he didn't like it, and he came back. He moved back after the big
anticlimactic. Back to Champaign?
I think so, yeah.
Then he moved to Chicago eventually.
Yeah, I think he moved back here first. I don't remember the order, but it was just kind of funny because poor guy, you know, just wanted to quietly do something, and everybody made this big hoopla about it, and then...
I think Chuck Seagard still has one of those Ron DeWar shirts, a yellow shirt.
Oh, wow.
Just Ron playing the sax.
I want to see Chuck. Chucker.
He's out and about sometimes. He doesn't get out that much.
Okay.
Well, do you have anywhere else you want to go? Or
I can't think of anything else.
Any parting thoughts?
Not really. I'm just, you know, very thankful for that I had that time, and that Terry and Shelley had that wonderful place.
Well, thank you for making the time today. Thanks,
Joan. Thank you.